Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And it's Mind Food Radio. Hello, Michael.
Hi. Well, how hot is the summer?
Hot? It's been pretty hot, hasn't it?
Is it really the hottest summer we've ever had?
I think it is. But you had fun. You were doing some fishing. Al
exactly.
Brown's coming on the show today.
He sure is. And I really like his philosophy in terms of not only how he cooks, but just his outlook on life in terms of, you know, not overfishing. We're doing a nice interview all about his seafood and stuff. But yeah, a really interesting guy.
I'm feeling itchy all of a sudden.
Yes, it is back to school, and not only back to school lunchboxes, but wait for it, head lice.
And we're going to be chatting with NLP expert Marvin Okar, not too far away, about the wonderful world behind the scenes of NLP treatments. All that and more today on Mind Food Radio.
Mind Food Radio, smart thinking, the perfect gift idea, is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Well, we've had Al Brown on the program before. This time, Michael thought he would get him back on the show to talk about seafood. I love seafood.
Well, Al, of course, has become one of our favourite chefs. In fact, he's now writing for Mind Food, and we love him being part of the team. And I was very fortunate at the end of last year to go and spend some time with Al and his team down in Wellington, and he went diving for power out in the harbour there. And we spent a great day. He rustled up the most beautiful recipes, which are going to be featured in the new issue. But welcome to the show, Al.
Thank you. It was a fun day, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really fun. I got terribly sunburned, but other than that, it was a good day.
Just nice to be out on the coast and with the Mind Food crew as well, which was great to meet them and just do what comes naturally, I guess. Find a bit of seafood and cook it up.
Now, you told us a really lovely story when you were a kid and you know, you remember heading out and going fishing and diving for par and stuff, and I think a lot of those food memories come from those times, don't they?
Yeah, it is actually. I mean, it's become a lot more poignant now because, I cook for a living, but, you know, when you actually think back to your first sort of real food memories, and certainly one of them for me was, you know, the first time that we went the fathers dived for the crayfish or the lobster, and the kids basically just stayed around in the rock pools, and we lifted rocks and found abalone and power and brought those home, and it was always a big celebration, and we'd light up the big barbecues, and we'd barbecue the lobsters, and we'd get an old mincer out and mince the power and make power fritters, and to be able to, it was poignant in the way that it was, it was the first time that you really think that you're actually adding to the pot, really, or you were helping provide, and that's where it all sort of started, I guess.
Did you ever think then, as a kid, that was something, you really wanted to do in your life? You know, you obviously had a lot of joy at that time, collecting and cooking and things like that, and being part of it within your family. Did you think then, at that young age, that this is something I always want to be involved with?
No, I think probably I just thought it was natural and that everyone was doing it.
Yeah.
But back at that, that was just what you did. Everyone went out and collected or gathered or foraged and brought home and ate it. It's actually dawned on me now when I look back on it that it was very, very special, and maybe it was sowing the seed for my career. I was always meant to be a farmer. My father was a farmer, and I was the only son. But I threw that in after about 12 months. So I found something that I loved, and food was it, really.
Yeah. But even there on that day where we spent together, both our teams, you really are a master of that very clean, honest sort of flavour where the food isn't played around too much. You know, that power fritter you made right there on the beach, and, even my young Henry at 10 was hoeing in and loved it, and, we got back home, and what was the first thing he said after everything we did on that trip? Oh, Mum, you should have seen what we ate. he just loved it. They are wonderful memories, aren't they?
Well, they are, and I think, all those eating experiences, of course, the product, you're right at the source of where you've found it, so it is as fresh as it possibly can be. But the thing that, my big thing, the longer I'm cooking, is it's more about people and place, and the memories that we have from just a simple situation of lighting a barbecue and cooking something in a spot where we've gathered the food. It is going to be a food memory that is etched in your mind forever because of who you're with and where you're with. And it was, we all love eating outdoors, and there's something extraordinary. There's some sort of freedom about it, and there's this, somehow that transfers into the eating experience some way, and that's the special ingredient that you'll never get inside four walls.
Al, thanks for being on the show today. Al Brown's seafood recipes are in the brand new edition of Mind Food that's on sale in February. I can tell you I've tried them all and they're all absolutely delicious. Talk to you next time, Al.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on, Mike.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Well, now we're at a segment, Michael, which is very, very interesting. Words and puzzles.
Well, they say as you get older, you should always do a daily crossword or a daily Sudoku so you keep the grey matter keep working.
Yeah.
But I've never actually talked to someone who makes those puzzles.
What a cool job, a crossword setter. We've got David on the line with us. Hello, David.
G'day, Ben. G'day, Michael.
Now, have you done your daily crossword?
I have. I always do. It's my daily fix.
How many would you do in a day?
Probably about three or four.
Wow.
Which sounds a little tragic, but... I will graze on them, they're at the kitchen bench, I'll put a few clues in and toddle off. Or it's also just a pleasant means of passing the time, waiting for the bus.
So do you have them throughout your house?
Yeah, it's a bit like a radio. I know for blind people, they have a radio in every room to keep them company.
Yeah.
And in my case, it's a crossword, I think, in every cranny.
How did you get into all that, though?
I've always been obsessed by words and wordplay. And in fact, one way of putting it is that my preoccupation has become my occupation.
Mm.
Growing up, just looking at words as a child, brand names and names in books and letters on billboards, I always just saw strange patterns. You know, even to think that Pepsi holds pipes or that in Mother Goose, who's the warm and trusting matriarch of fairy tales, holds ogre backwards inside her name. That always just freaked me out.
So there's always a cryptic side to it, hey?
Yeah, there is. And I think that what delights me is to imagine that every word holds a secret and holds a story, not just in its origins, where it's come from and how it's all the meanders it's taken to get to us, but the letters themselves, what they can hold with some rearrangement or looking at them freshly.
So do you ever switch off, though? Because I would imagine during your day you would see so many things that would probably set your mind off wandering about words and phrases.
It's a great question because it is important to switch off as much as I love diving into language. And I suppose two of the solaces I find are just in sport. I do play still a very amateur form of touch football, which is great because it's without language, and also like just immersing myself in music, particularly music that where the lyrics are not as preeminent.
Now, you've got a brand new book coming out, Puzzles and Words. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this is a little apropos of what I was just saying about the secrets behind words. This is a book that looks at over, you know, 200 or 300 words and what where they've come from. You know, fascinating stuff like that even the word Google was invented by a 9-year-old boy in the 1930s because his mathematical uncle just wanted a word for a number that had one followed by 100 zeros. So Google is actually a family word. I love that.
God, I always thought it was some crazy scientist who would have done that. You know,
yeah, you'd
that
think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Or someone paid a lot of money for it.
And then the book also plays around with the anagrams and riddles and things that connect to the word stories you've just read.
What's your new word that you've found recently that you love?
Let me think. Well, it's actually a made-up word, but I think it has real potential. And it's fub. P-H-U-B.
Spell it again?
Yeah, look, it sounds a bit rude. I should spell it out. P-H-U-B. And the reason I love it is because I think it describes something that happens to us every day, but we don't have a word for it. It's when you've been snubbed by someone using their phone. So you're at the table and, you know, like Ben's talking to Michael and suddenly Michael's not there because he's checking out his email or doing his tweet.
That's a given.
Yeah, that's right. It's just been snubbed by a phone or phone snubbed or fub.
Well, look, I hate to sub you, but I think our time's up.
Oh, is that right?
Don't fub. David Astle.
Snub and not fub, that's fine.
Thank you, David. That's David Astle joining us today, the author of Puzzles and Words.
Mind Food Radio, smart thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
It's Mind Food Radio, now time to head into the leftover section, the healthy lunchbox, hey? Kate DePrima is joining us. How are you, Kate?
I'm very well, very well.
Do you know one of my favourite parts of Christmas Day is actually the leftovers? You know, the old turkey and the lamb and ham and whatever, and having that at night on toast. And I've got to say, leftovers always seem to taste better the next day.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true, because they actually sort of they become stronger because the fluid sort of reduces a little bit, so it sort of just makes it a lot richer the next day within the 24-hour period. So, yes, you are absolutely true.
Now, as kids are heading back to school and we're all getting back into our routine, you know, we've got all sorts of wonderful diet and nutrition plans, you know, that we hope we stick with. But I think this is a great one in terms of how to love leftovers and create nutritious lunchboxes. So what are some ideas on how we can do that?
Your last night's dinner is today's lunch is a great solution, because especially for those fussy eaters, the children have already seen it the night before, so they've already tasted it, they know what it is, so it's familiar food. My biggest bugbear, I guess, in lunch boxes is that they're just not balanced, and we're looking for those protein-rich foods that are high in iron and zinc, and they are things like your red meat, so you've got your beef and your lamb and then your chicken and fish, and then you've also got legumes and eggs. This is what's missing in most people's lunch boxes when they have a honey sandwich, a Vegemite sandwich, or, you know, a jam sandwich.
Yeah.
And these little children, they just run out of oomph half an hour after lunch. So that's why we're trying to make it more sustaining. So solutions would be even something simple like last night's rissoles. You can cut them in half and put them into a wrap.
Mm.
The roast from the night before, you can cut slices and either put those onto a sandwich with crackers or even toss through a salad. So it's a really quick and easy thing to do as well, because it's already there the minute you open the fridge door.
The interesting thing, you know, we do a column in the magazine and online called Dinner Tonight, Lunch Tomorrow, and it's one of our most favourite. And it's, you know, you take whatever you've got for dinner and the main meal, and then you create quite a different meal for lunch. And we always make sure that it's a portable meal that you can take into the office, or it's kid friendly. But it's amazing how simple those ideas are in terms of reworking that meal.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I delight when I basically look into the fridge and I think, oh, we've had bolognese the night before, especially in winter, because you just throw a serve of that into a bowl, heat it up in the microwave, and put it in one of these Ubiquit little thermos things that have come out these days.
Yeah.
And my daughter loves that for lunch, and her thought processes are better, her recall, she can concentrate, you know, she says she feels better, she's got a lot more energy after lunch compared to just a basic sandwich.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is quick and easy, it's something they've seen before, and it fills them up and it gives them sort of the nourishment, this high protein, high iron, high zinc nutrition that they're looking for.
You know, when I was a kid at school, you know, the fancy kids had a box of raisins, that was their big thing. Is that still popular in school lunch boxes?
Well, it's becoming very, very complex now. They're tradable, believe it or not.
Yeah.
So there's things that kids can trade for other things. So things like, you know, wraps that are a little bit more, you know, have a bit more
gourmet wraps.
Yeah, the gourmet wraps, if they look nice. And I think kids are starting to get sportier and a little bit more competitive and healthier. So they are looking for those things. And because nutrition is being taught at a very early age in the schools, they're starting to learn about foods that are important for them as well. And also for some of these slightly older children out there, mine are 9 and 12 now, and I'm getting them to actually put their own lunch boxes together.
Yeah.
So last night's dinner is really easy for them.
Good start.
If we've had a couple of lamb chops, they just throw those into a container, and, you know, a nice school or sort of school teacher may actually give them a quick microwave for them if it's cool at lunchtime. And it's easy. It's really easy. Little thing of tomato sauce and off you go. And that's a nourishing lunch. So, you know, you don't have to overpack the lunchbox, but you've got to put a couple of key ingredients in. And one of these things is that, you know, last night's dinner is today's lunch.
Perfect advice. Kate, thank you very much for being on today's show. And I want to come and stay at your house. I like the sound of your meals and lunches you're having up there.
Thank you so much.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Now on Mind Food Radio, are you feeling itchy on the scalp? Every time someone says head lice, I go,
oh, I know. And do you know what? We've actually done a story in the magazine, and there's a picture of this kid itching his head.
Yeah.
I didn't even need to read what it was about. I knew exactly what it was.
Exactly.
Having kids at primary school, I can't tell you how much money we have spent on head lice treatments.
Really?
And it's really interesting. Mm. And how the note comes home, you know, oh, there's a head lice outbreak. And so, so what I thought, as, you know, kids are heading back to school, we would actually talk about it. So back to school head lice. Normally it's back to school lunchbox solutions.
Exactly.
But I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Karen Grieve. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, do you specialise in head lice?
Yes, look, I'm the head of research and development for MOVE at Ego Pharmaceuticals. And
okay.
We have done clinical research in the area of head lice.
Now, let's go right back. What is actually head lice? What are they made of? How do people get them?
Head lice are a very small insect that like to live on our scalp. They like to live in our hair, and they actually feed off our blood, which sounds really quite horrible. And we catch them from other people that have an infestation already.
And how long do they actually survive?
Well, if they're on the hair, they can survive for about 21 days.
Oh.
And during that time, they can grow, they can lay more eggs, and actually the cycle of head lice can go on for quite some time if we don't intervene and use a treatment.
Is it mainly kids that get it?
Look, it is mostly young children that get it, and that's because of the way they interact socially. To catch a head lice infestation, you need direct head-to-head or hair-to-hair contact. So as adults, we don't tend to huddle in groups and have head-to-head contact, whereas young children, particularly primary school children, they like to work together. The girls have long hair.
Mm.
So they are more likely to catch it.
And once it happens, it probably goes through a whole school very quickly, hey?
Look, it can go through a school very, very quickly, and that's why it's really important that the teachers are vigilant, but also the parents are vigilant. And it's very important that, it can be embarrassing to have head lice infestation, but for the sake of the school and the other people at school, it's really important that the parents let the school know that their child has head lice.
Yeah.
Just so that the other parents can, get on top of it, check their kids. And if the school as a group, monitors it really closely and treats as soon as an infestation is found, then they have a much better chance of controlling it.
What do they look like, head lice? Do you have to put them under a microscope or...?
No, actually, they're frighteningly big when you see them.
I've never seen one.
Oh, come on.
No,
haven't you?
No.
Little white things.
No.
They're about 2 to 3 millimetres long, and you can see, distinct legs and distinct body segments, and you definitely recognise them as a very small insect.
Now, can you say that this is not... a class thing or anything like that?
Oh, definitely not. Look, it doesn't matter, what your social standing.
That's
or
right.
It doesn't matter if you've got clean hair or if you haven't washed your hair for a week. Lice just like to live in our hair, and once they've taken hold, they'll happily live there for quite some time.
Now tell me, what are some of the worst cases you've seen?
Oh, gosh.
Oh, come on, let's get there.
Look, the one that most immediately comes to mind was in a clinical trial that we did, we removed over 500 lice from one child.
Oh, my God.
Now, did you do that with a comb or a treatment? How did you do that?
Well, what we did was, first of all, we treated the child to kill the lice in the eggs. And this particular clinical trial, we were interested in having a look at the lice in the eggs to make sure they were all dead. So once we'd done the treatment, we then used a metal tooth comb to remove all the eggs and the lice from the hair, just so we could count them.
Listen, thank you very much for being on today's show. I know it's... do you know what? I think it's one of those things, if we talk about it, never seems as bad as, in practice.
And it's definitely... that's what we found, in all the clinical testing. If you talk about it, if you're very relaxed about it, it just becomes a part of life that, you deal with. And there's really good treatments out there that you can get onto it quickly.
Yep.
And there's also great products that can help you defend against an infestation, and prevention is so much better than cure.
It's part of the general grooming, hey?
That's it, yeah.
Fantastic. Doctor, thank you for joining us today on the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's Mind Food Radio with Ben and Michael. Marvin Ocker joins us now. We're talking about NLP. We've done a few interviews in the past about this.
We sure have. Welcome to the show, Marvin.
Oh, great. Thank you. It's great to be on the show.
Now, listen, just to bring everyone up to speed, can you just tell everyone what NLP is?
NLP is the acronym for Neuro-Linguistic Programming. It was a behavioral technology that was developed in the early to mid-70s, and it's now widespread in the range of personal development to business communication.
So when you say personal development and business communication, is it learning the art of just that, communication, but also being aware of yourself?
Yes, a lot of being aware of your own internal processing that allows you to do the behaviors that you do, whether they're working for you or not.
Mm. What about people that want to make changes? Is it hard to make changes?
No, one of the great things that NLP has discovered is that change is actually quite easy. You're actually designed to actually learn and to actually develop new patterns as an adaptive response. And one of the latest researches that we find in neuroscience is that we actually have three functioning brains. We actually have a head brain, a heart brain, and a gut brain. These are actually three adaptive neural networks. And it's a latest piece of research that my colleague Grant Siswell and I have worked on called M-braining, which stands for multiple braining.
I thought it stood for mind food braining.
Maybe that's a better way to go.
Sorry, couldn't resist.
So you hear about that in the past where people, you know, think with their, you know, heart on their sleeve or their gut feeling. Is it, it links into all that type of stuff?
Yes, exactly. That these phrases that we typically use, they're not just made out of thin air. They actually have some neurological resonance. For instance, you don't hear people saying, you know, I deeply felt that from the bottom of my elbow. You know, it just doesn't neurologically make sense. And why across cultures they do reference the heart when they're talking about emotive issues and values-based issues and people relations, and why we talk about gut instinct having to do with protection, boundary, and even identity issues, because these are what the neural networks do, and it has a significant implication for how we do coaching, personal development, training, and even the raising of children.
Really? And where do you think, though, upbringing and environment comes into this? Because I'm sure you, in your 30 years of NLP trainer, have come across many, many people with many different walks of life that perhaps want to have a very successful end goal, but they have a big journey to kind of overcome before they get there.
Yeah, a lot has to do with how the neural networks have learned over time. So, for instance, if you've grown up in a particularly tough environment, your gut brain would have learned how to protect yourself. And sometimes it might have also sent signals to your heart where you've heard the phrase, a hardened heart. What happens is people close off to some of their emotions, and they work predominantly either from their gut or their head. And it was a survival mechanism. And if that's the case, yeah, there's a bit of deprogramming or reprogramming that needs to happen. But the great thing is that these are neural networks. They are designed to learn. They're designed to adapt. And they're designed to grow to keep you alive.
So, you know, as we start a new year and this whole new concept of, you know, I guess a broader brain or a bigger brain or multiple brains, how do we tap into that?
Yeah, there are several things that you have to do to actually tap into your gut brain and your heart brain, which is really the essence of your intuitions as well. And the first thing is you have to make sure that you're not in an overly stressed or an overly lethargic state. Technically, these are known as overly sympathetic or parasympathetic based on your autonomic nervous system. And there's a very simple and direct practice you can do, which is that of what's called balanced breathing. When you breathe in, it activates your sympathetic system. When you breathe out, it activates your parasympathetic. And basically what that means is nature has designed you to reach a state of optimum performance or neurological balance through natural breathing processes. And so this is why every spiritual practice, every wisdom practice has built into it some form of breathing practice, because that is how you get back to a balanced state, which then allows your intuitive signals to begin to flow. And from there, you can set much wiser goals and have a much wiser sense of how to actually take certain kinds of actions and decisions in your life.
Mm. Well, Marvin, thank you very much for joining us on today's program. Very interesting and insightful. Thanks, Marvin.
Thank you.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
It's Mind Food Radio, to the segment of the program that we love to talk about, My Story.
That's right. We get lots of feedback from My Story. I get sent many emails from people that have either listened to one of the My Stories on Mind Food Radio or in the magazine. Today, I'd like to welcome to the show Josie Galliano. Being a carer is a non-stop job, as many of you out there would know. But sometimes you'd like just to clock off and just be you. And I know you can sometimes juggle so many balls and keep things happening. So welcome to the show, Josie.
Thank you so much, Michael. Great to speak with you.
Now, over the last 5 years, your life has been mostly, I guess, about others, particularly your mother and your twins, one of them with autism. Can you tell us about your story?
Okay. Well, I guess my father died many years ago when I was 13 and my mum was in her early 50s. So I guess I kind of adopted that caring role, whether I liked it or not, many years ago, and that kind of stayed with me and became part of my personality. So it was interesting when I finally had my babies. I had twins 5 years ago, and a few months in, my mum got quite ill, and then I reverted again to being her carer, and, you know, obviously already with my full-time role of being mum of twins. So it was kind of confronting, because I guess we kind of write our life script in our head, and when it doesn't go the way we expected, it's confronting, and it brings up all sorts of emotions that you can't kind of control and that surprise you. So I guess, you know, being a carer, that comes with the territory of being a mum, but when you have all these extra elements like you've just described, it's really confronting.
Just give us some practical advice about how you manage it all.
Well, I think the first thing to do is to acknowledge that it is a tough task, and it seemingly feels like it will last, this period of hardship, I guess, will last forever. But for me, I just kept thinking in my brain, and I still do to this day, that this is a time that will pass, a time that hopefully does get easier. And top of the list for me was keeping interest from my past life when I was a little bit more footloose and fancy-free, very important. So as a freelance journo and an ex-editor, for me, staying connected with my networks was super important.
When you actually went back and you spent time with those people, perhaps they were ex-work colleagues or old friends, did a lot of their life seem quite trivial, and some of the things they were talking about, whether it was work issues or whatever, quite trivial, and you really just didn't have time for it?
It's been a particularly hard 12 months, so a couple of friendships have kind of fallen by the wayside because of that. But by the same token, going back into that media sphere and talking with my media pals and you know, even old friends, any lighthearted banter actually made things easier for me to deal with, and kind of strangely put things in perspective in reverse, so to speak. Yeah. I kind of felt like, you know what, there is a world out there that is fun and light and humorous, and, you know, humor is the thing that's always kept me going. So it was actually a great outlet for me, and it was crucial to my mental well-being. There's certain elements of you that you want to retain, and I guess when you're a carer, it kind of gets lost in the whole day-to-day drudgery and responsibilities and commitments. And so having, you know, my writing work, for example, and my blogging, super important for me, very important. It honestly has kept me sane all this time. And, you know, social networking has been very important for me, and, you know, old school friends. So I guess for me, mixing elements of my old and new life was absolutely vital.
Josie, thank you very much for your time today on Mind Food Radio. I think a lot of people will have appreciated your honesty in terms of how to, I guess, shift your focus when you are a non-stop carer out there. And you certainly juggle lots of balls, and I take my hat off to you. And
thank
for
you.
Anyone listening, Josie's full story is going to be in the new edition of Mind Food coming out in February. Thanks, Josie.
Thank you so much, Michael.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
Well, Michael, are you all cheered up?
Well, you know, there's always some new superfood or super ingredient. And we've actually had one of the farmers on the show
last year.
And we've got the story coming up written by Carly Ratcliffe. And we've got Carly on the show today. Hi, Carly.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good. Now, did you travel out to the Kimberleys?
You know, I wish I had travelled out to Kimberley. I haven't been there, but John Foss is a farmer who I came into contact with probably 3 or 4 years ago when chia first kind of hit the market. I was quite intrigued by these little black seeds, and just looking at the back of a packet in a health food store, it said, you know, Ord River Valley, Kimberley, Western Australia. I thought, this is very, you know, odd. Mm. And so I tracked him down, and we kind of had some initial chats then when he was establishing the crop, and then again became reacquainted with him recently in writing the story for Mind Food.
Now, historically, it was always sort of used in Mexican food, wasn't it, I think? Is that right?
That's right. It's it has a long history in Central and South America. Mm. So it's native to Mexico. But the Aztecs were very big consumers of chia. And they, Aztec warriors, allegedly used to mix chia with water, or even carry them dry in little pouches when they went off, you know, to war.
So they're almost like gold.
Yeah. Absolutely. They considered them more precious than gold because I mean, I guess in those days they didn't know the actual essential mineral and nutrient breakdown, but what they did know was that they were absolutely an appetite suppressant and gave them some kind of, you know, extra warrior powers or strength or longevity.
They're higher in omega-3, aren't they?
Super high. And the John Foss, who was on the program, as you were saying, late last year, the farmer from the Kununurra, his particular chia, because of the location of the property in the Ord River Valley, because latitudinally it has very low rainfall, very high hours of sunlight, so you've got that extra photosynthesis, so that's what helps with omega-3. So the local Australian chia has the highest strains of omega-3 in the world. So
well,
the
I
entire plant-based omega-3 source.
And I think he's a fourth-generation farmer, and he was interesting to talk to in terms of how he sort of came across it and then went and discovered that that was the best area when he looked globally where it should be grown. But can you imagine the conversation with his old, you know, family and farmer mates to say, this is what I think we should do.
This is what we'll do.
Because, you know, for us, it is sort of become a bit of a new buzzword in health circles, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And John was telling me that, yes, those farmers were incredibly sceptical. So as he probably explained to you, he's working with a number of local farmers who contract grow for him.
Uh-huh.
But men and families who have been on the land in that part of Western, very remote part of Western Australia for many, many years, many of them were actually sugarcane farmers.
Oh, okay.
And so they still apparently farm sugar some of the year, but put the chia in as well.
Yeah.
And because the chia is growing so well, it's really that diversification for them of the crop has really helped their livelihoods as well, which is terrific in a very remote, you know, desolate part of the country that I guess, you know, is prone to drought and all of those other environmental factors that are such a concern.
Having now written the piece and sort of known more about it, have you started using it?
Oh, look, I have used it for many years, probably since I first spoke to John about 4 years ago. And I use it for all kinds of things. In muesli for breakfast cereal, I bake it into chocolate. I've got this fantastic chocolate chia cake recipe that I, you know, make for my daughter. She doesn't know they're in there. I'm sending her off to school with, you know, a bit of protein inside. You can't taste it inside the cake.
Carly Ratcliffe, thank you very much for joining us today and talking about chia. Very, very interesting. Of course, it's in the March issue. For more details, go to mindfood.com.
Thanks, Carly.
You're most welcome. Thanks so much.
Mind Food Radio, smart thinking, the perfect gift idea, is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
It's Mind Food Radio. Thank you for joining us today. Now, we're going to be chatting with a festival curator. I like chatting to festival curators. Mona Foma. What's that all about, Brian Ritchie?
Mona Foma means Museum of Old and New Art, Festival of Music and Art in Tasmania.
In Tasmania. Now, when's this all taking place?
Starts on January 16th and runs through the 20th, although now we've added another day on the 21st, which is going to be a bushfire benefit concert.
Fantastic idea.
We've added an extra day, plus on the 23rd we have Elvis Costello as kind of an encore presentation.
Oh, how cool. Now, Elvis Costello, is he married to Diana Krall?
I think he is,
that's right.
We only have him. I'd like to have both of them.
Yeah. So tell us about the festival this year. What have you got coming up?
Well, we've got Elvis and David Byrne would be probably the two biggest artists. But because we're affiliated with MONA, which is the great art museum down here in Hobart, we've got also visual art, and, such as Robin Fox's giant theremin, which is kind of a sculptural musical instrument that people can play. And we've got fantastic classical music, opera, hip-hop, jazz, everything. It's a pretty wide-ranging festival.
Now, have you got lots of acts coming in from other states and around the world?
It's about one-third Tasmanian, one-third Australian, and one-third international or sometimes interplanetary, depending on how they feel about it.
Now, where's it all taking place? Can you tell us details about that?
Our main venue is Prince's Wharf 1, which is a vintage wharf, which has historic status. It's a huge, wide-open kind of warehouse-type structure on the waterfront in Hobart.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have satellite venues such as Town Hall, City Hall, the Theatre Royal, which is the oldest continuously operating theatre in Australia, and it's a beautiful little gem. And the Baha'i Centre, St. Mary's Cathedral. So all of these things are within walking distance of each other, so if people come down, they can just walk from venue to venue, and it's really a lot of fun, especially at this time of year.
Yeah, now I just noticed here, if families are down around that way, if you're under 12, you're admitted free, so that's good.
And we also give a 20% discount to parents who bring their kids.
Oh, that's really nice. Now tell me, where can we get tickets for this fantastic event?
www.mofo.net.au. We'll give you all the information you need to know, including a downloadable program, PDF, and everything.
Now, I was going to ask you one other question. Being a festival curator, how do you come up with these types of ideas for these types of shows? And when you're looking for acts, what are you looking for?
Well, as you notice, we don't particularly concentrate on a style of music, so what I concentrate on is an attitude towards making music, and it's always the musicians who are really stretching themselves, trying new things, people who, over the course of their musical history, have sought out new ideas. Mm-hmm. So that's how I choose the artist, not based on, like, it's not a rock festival or any particular
festival. Now, for next year, if people want to get involved, do they just contact you directly or go through the website to be a performer?
Yeah, I'm accessible. I'm pretty accessible. You can even contact me on Facebook.
Fantastic. All right. Well, Brian Ritchie, thank you very much for joining us on today's program, talking about Mona Foma, the big festival down there in Tasmania. And that's taking place between January 16th right through to the 20th. And then you've got that special benefit concert on the 21st for the bushfires. Great idea. Thank you for your time today, Brian.
Thanks so much.
Well, that's a wrap today, Michael.
It sure
is. From head lice to seafood.
A nice show, a nice range of guests.
Very, very nice. Al Brown, really interesting guy, very passionate about seafood and stuff, isn't he?
That's right. And for more of his recipes, just head to mindfood.com.
And of course, NLP, did you learn something about that?
Look, it's interesting, isn't it? I think it's all about sort of knowing yourself and learning how to communicate. That's the key thing.
I like doing kinesiology on the air with you, you know, where you've got the muscle testing.
I find that embarrassing.
Very much so. And of course, for more details, you can jump on to mindfood.com. And what about the new app?
That's right. We won Best App from Apple at the end of 2012. So, yes, you can go head to the iStore, the Apple iStore, and buy the Mind Food app.
And until next week, take care. Have a safe week. I'm Ben.
And I'm Michael. Have a great week.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking, was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.